History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The space race in the 20th century was a giant contest of national glory between the United States and the Soviet Union on getting a bunch of firsts. The first man to reach space, the first man to reach orbit, and the first man to land on the moon. In the 19th century, there was a similar type of race going on, and it focused on polar expeditions. Which nation would be the first to send a crew to reach the shores of Antarctica, to set foot on Antarctica, to reach Magnetic South, to reach the actual South Pole? And there were also things happening in the North, like the first nation to cross the Northwest Passage, which nations had sought to do since the age of Columbus. Well, there were famous expeditions, such as the John Franklin Expedition of 1845, which ended a complete and total disaster, where two crews were lost, and they likely fell to starvation and cannibalism and death. But there were also heroic chapters, like Ernest Shackleton's trip to Antarctica, where all the crew were heroically saved from death. Today, I'm looking at another famous voyage, the Belgica, which is mostly forgotten to history, but this was one of the first polar expeditions to Antarctica at the end of the 19th century. The voyage was meant to bring fame to all aboard the ship, and it certainly did, but at a very steep cost and not quite in the way the crew imagined. Today, I'm speaking to Julian Sancton, author of the new book, Madhouse at the End of the Earth, The Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. The Belgica was funded by the Belgian government, and it ultimately earned its fame as a survival story after the ship and her inhabitants became trapped in ice over a period of 13 months. The ice threatened to crush the ship every single day, and the men of the Belgica were subjected to a months-long sentence of physical and mental anguish, and they became the first humans to confront the horrors of a completely sunless Antarctic winter. So through the story, you learn a lot about physical endurance, about why some people simply can't make it, and there were crew members who lost their sanity and went out onto the frozen ice and just walked out and never returned. But you also learn about incredible resilience. One such crew member was Roald Amundsen, who famously became the first man to cross a Northwest Passage and reach the South Pole and may have reached the North Pole in an airplane. In fact, those who do remember the Belgica today are mainly the teams at NASA who study the lessons it offers on the physical and psychological limits of the human body as they look towards potentially manned expeditions to Mars. So there's a lot of stories about the Belgica that apply to today and the 21st century and the future. This is a very important chapter in the history of exploration and Arctic exploration in particular. And I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Julian Sancton. Julian, welcome to the show.
Scott, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm interested in the age of Arctic exploration because I really can't imagine doing anything much more miserable or terrifying than this, other than space exploration, dying a terrible death. I think that it's just about the top. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but it sounds pretty horrifying.
It does. And at the same time, it has a strange allure, especially towards the turn of the 20th century. There were a number of explorers competing to grab these brass rings of Arctic and, in this case, Antarctic exploration. There was a number of people vying for the North Pole, probably four that I can think of, four expeditions in the mid-1890s by the time that the Belgica expedition that I write about got underway. But the Antarctic didn't have as many people vying for it, and I think for good reason, because it was that much further and involved that much more of a commitment and was almost entirely unknown, save for a few sketchy coastlines. So it was a daunting proposition, to say the least. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to start by looking at what people thought of Arctic exploration, also Antarctic exploration in the time in the 1890s, because as you said, not much is known. Captain Cook in the 1700s may have very faintly skirted the edges of the Antarctic. And there had been numerous attempts to find the Northwest Passage by the British and others. Famously, in the 1840s, Sir John Franklin's expedition is completely lost, and they don't know what happened, but there's rumors that the expedition descended into starvation and cannibalism and death and everything else.
Yeah.
But this is also a few decades before, I think, the Shackleton expedition. So where is polar expedition? Are people terrified due to lost voyages, or are they still thinking that there's much glory to be found? This is some of the last places of terra incognita. This is the goldmine of national glory. What are people and explorers thinking at this time?
Well, there's definitely a few expeditions that loom large over the history of polar exploration. You named a few, and certainly the Franklin expedition had a profound effect, both in part because of how the tragic turn that it took, upwards of 130 people died and were found only much, much later. And many expeditions were actually launched in order to find the traces of the Franklin expedition. And in turn, some of those ended up running into trouble. And so that, I think, had kind of both a dampening effect in Arctic exploration because it showed how dangerous it was, how costly it was, and the pitfalls of it. But at the same time, for younger explorers who grew up in the decades that followed, you mentioned Shackleton, he's one of them, but even earlier than that, Adrien de Gerlache, who's my commander of the Belgica, they were enamored with this. I mean, the more harrowing, the more exciting. And it had kind of a perverse effect in motivating them to try to follow it in their wake. You mentioned Franklin. There are some explorers who had much better luck and who were probably better prepared and more skillful, I guess. One of them is Ross's expedition, who had also commanded the same ships as John Franklin. And his expeditions went off with nary a hitch, both in the Arctic and the Antarctic. But those didn't have as powerful an effect. I think there's this almost masochism to some of the explorers. And I think none of the characters that I write about experienced that draw towards that almost lust for suffering as much as Roald Amundsen, who was the first mate on the Belgica and ended up becoming probably the most, I guess, accomplished polar explorer of all time. Not to jump too far ahead into the story, but he reached the South Pole first and ended up blazing the Northwest Passage first. And there's a good chance that he got to the North Pole first. And he was motivated by specifically that expedition you named, which is the tragic expedition of John Franklin. But yes, there in the immediate wake of the Franklin expedition, it actually, there was maybe, 50 years between Franklin expedition and the Belgica expedition to Antarctica. Even though they were opposite ends of the earth, I do think that no government really wanted to risk tremendous amount of resources in an expedition that had a high likelihood of being lost.
Yeah, I don't want to skip ahead to Amundsen either, but amazing person. It's sort of like if the same person was both the first to reach the moon and Mars. I mean, one of them would put you at the top of the history books of explorers, but both of them, it's amazing. But without getting too far ahead, could you walk me through how the Belgica expedition was put together? Because when you read about these accounts, it's very interesting where sometimes there's government funding. Typically, if we're looking at the case of a British exploration, the Royal Geographic Society funds. But then there's usually one, sometimes eccentric, but interesting man who puts it together. And he has a bit of showmanship, sort of a P.T. Barnum meets Elon Musk meets Silicon Valley venture capitalist. So how does this come together with the Belgica?
I think the man who was at the origin of the Belgica, who's concocted this crazy dream that Belgium, of all places, should be the first to launch a scientific expedition to the Antarctic, again, the aforementioned de Gerlache, was not really a P.T. Barnum character. He was a bit kind of a shy and very sensitive, thoughtful young man who had dreams of traveling across the seas and to the poles. It was a strange vocation for a young Belgian aristocrat, given that Belgium had no naval tradition to speak of. They had only 60 miles of coastline. And since their split from the Netherlands in 1830, they had sort of relinquished a vast portion of that region's maritime responsibilities and duties to the Netherlands. And so there really wasn't a maritime tradition. And yet, he dreamt of nothing more than the sea. He was miserable on land. And so he became an accomplished sailor. And the king at the time, Leopold II, had heard of him because there were so few promising naval prospects. And that was a source of embarrassment for the king, who, in that time of nation building and jingoism, really wanted to have a navy he could be proud of. But his immediate priority in reaching out to de Gerlache when he was a young naval lieutenant was that he wanted somebody to help him chart the river system in the Congo, which was not, as is commonly thought, a colony of Belgium, but rather something, an enormous swath of land in Central Africa that he claimed as his personal property, in which he permitted and encouraged, perpetrated some of the worst horrors any man has ever committed on another. And de Gerlache didn't want anything to do with that. I'm not sure whether the extent of the atrocities were known at that time, although they were suspected. But I think it's because he had his eye on a more distant prospect and on colder horizons, specifically the poles, which he had dreamt of as a kid. And the Antarctic had a particular allure to him because it hadn't been explored for 50 years. And even 50 years before that had been very, very, I guess, you know, superficially and, you know, marginally explored. So he took to this crazy idea that as a man in his mid-20s, he should lead this non-maritime power or an expedition on behalf of a non-maritime nation to the furthest reaches of human exploration. And he ran into a wall, basically. There was no desire, even though all the geographical societies of the world were in agreement that this was an urgent priority to explore the void at the bottom of world maps. Nobody, he had a lot of trouble in raising the funds for it. And ultimately, the government declined to fund it at first, and it was only thanks to an initiative to raise funds from the people themselves. It was called a national subscription, which was a strange model, but it ended up raising just enough funds to kind of shame the government into contributing just a little more. And it was an underfunded expedition, to say the least, but he had enough to purchase a ship and rustle up a bare bones crew of unqualified Belgian and somewhat qualified Norwegian sailors.
And I'm curious about putting the crew together because there's the famous, although most likely fictitious, newspaper ad for Ernest Shackleton's crew that said, "Men wanted for hazardous journey, low wages, bitter cold, long hours of complete darkness, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition event of success." Listeners, sorry to say, but I don't think that there's evidence that ad exists, but it's such a good story. You just want to believe that it's true. But yeah. I think it speaks to something that there's just no way to spin an Arctic expedition as pleasant. So why not lean into it the way that if you're a former Navy SEAL, that you talk about Hell Week, you talk about how horrible it is. And to the right person, they're going to hear that and they're going to think, that's me. I can do that. But how did he get a crew together for an expedition like this?
He started with the scientists because this was the, I wouldn't say pretext, but it was the justification for the trip. And in the 19th century, science became more and more predominant as a motivation for these kinds of expeditions. You think of Alexander von Humboldt, you think of Charles Darwin. It became a kind of a sporting competition between nations to see who could gather the most data, you know, around the world. And it was after having sort of conquered the globe, the Western world decided to start understanding it. And so that was the way that that de Gerlache was able to drum up some enthusiasm was by pitching this as a scientific journey. And so he began with a number of scientists, but he couldn't, you know, he had nothing to pay them with. And all the prominent Belgian scientists who were at first on board, or at least understood the importance of a well-organized and well-staffed scientific mission to this unknown corner of the globe, some had initially signed up and volunteered to join this, but it took so long to get the expedition underway, and it looked like he really didn't know what he was doing, de Gerlache, and it looked like it was going to be underfunded, and a lot of them got spooked. And so the only scientists he could find were this, the first one he could find was a sort of self-taught, brilliant, but uncertified Polish geologist and meteorologist named Henryk Artkowski. And so once he was on board, and he figured that he didn't have a diploma, so the Belgica would be his diploma. Again, not a stellar curriculum vitae there, but he was absolutely brilliant. And once he was on board, they invited another Eastern European scientist named Emil Racoviță, who was a Romanian zoologist. And so it was already kind of tricky for de Gerlache that the only two scientists he could find for this Belgian scientific exploration were not Belgian. So he understood that he needed to work as hard as he could to find Belgian sailors. And the ones he was able to find, as I mentioned before, Belgium did not have a strong maritime tradition. So the ones he could find were, you know, either just shy of you know, mercenaries, and or they lied about their naval experience in order to, you know, to jump aboard and have a taste of adventure. And so really they were a ragtag group, the Belgian sailors. And he realized this, that they not only did they not have much sailing experience, but they certainly didn't have the experience that was required for a multi-year journey through polar ice. So he realized that he needed to start recruiting from a country that had more experience with that. And that would be Norway, where the sailors had experience with whaling in the Arctic Circle. And it was, there's a much stronger maritime tradition and it's steeped in Viking myths. It's very hard to find a Norwegian who knows nothing about boats. So that's how he ended up staffing his ship with equal parts Belgian and foreign crew. And then came the command, and he had an application. He received an application from a Norwegian adventurer, I guess. He had been on a few sailing expeditions, but he was just this, he seemed like he was ripped out of storybooks, that out of a Jules Verne book. His name was Roald Amundsen, and he couldn't believe his luck. This guy just was a Viking incarnate. And so he made him his first mate, which was, again, another problem. The first mate, in according to the, not necessarily the law of the sea, but maritime tradition, is the one who would stand to inherit command of the ship should anything happen to the captain. And so, again, that posed a problem for what was pitched as a national endeavor, that should Der Zalash perish, and this was, there was a high likelihood of that happening given the hostility of the Antarctic environment, then a Norwegian would inherit the command. And so that posed a problem from the get-go, one that dogged him throughout the expedition, that dogged Der Zalash, and ended up leading to some pretty poor decision making.
That's an interesting point you make. When you're putting together a crew for an expedition like this, you have a Venn diagram where one circle are people willing to go on an expedition like this, and the other circle is people who have the capability and character to survive for months or years in dangerous conditions and resolve and discipline. And there's not a lot where those two circles overlap. So you get things like, I think it was Magellan or the Conquistadors, who much of their crew were former or convicts that were released by the crown to go on this. And surprise, surprise, they mutiny when they're at sea because they're convicts. So not quite that bad at Belgica, but as you described, it's not the ideal crew. So a little
tricky. Well, it definitely did lead to an attempt at a mutiny, which came very close to succeeding. But, I'm glad, and partly because of what happened to the Belgica, which we'll get to, it became imperative afterwards for a lot of these expeditions to screen people ahead of time. And I think a lot of expeditions that followed learned their lessons from the Belgica. And I'm glad that the space programs in the second half of the 20th century and now are much more rigorous on that front, that we're not sending, ex-cons to, or not even ex-cons, that we're not sending in some cases convicts or unstable, adventurers out into the furthest reaches of space. That was the biggest problem with the Belgica is I think came down to the staffing. These people just were not prepared for what was to come.
I suppose we've lost that in the space age, where it's so expensive to send a flight that you're not just looking, okay, let's go to a juvenile detention center and see if anyone's willing to sign up. You have a vetting and screening process, so I guess that's different.
I don't know how much the Russians scanned Laika for psychological problems, but when you feel like if a government were to put this together, I think they would have made different choices than Der Zalash made out of expediency and out of just the strictures of the budget he was working with.
Which, gives us the colorful characters that maybe you wouldn't have if they were well together. But So when the voyage or the crew is put together, when they set sail, metaphorically speaking, and they're headed south, what is the journey like when they leave Belgium and they're headed to Antarctica?
It was... It took them, it took them a total of about 4 months to get down to South America, to the bottom of South America. It was, aside from the usual seasickness, a pretty straightforward journey to Brazil with an idyllic stopover in Madeira, where they, drank wine and ate local hams and were treated like, the glorious explorers they imagined themselves to be. And same thing in Brazil, where they were feted day after day in these lavish and bounteous celebrations, including by the president of Brazil and the various geographical and academic societies. Then things started going awry at the next stop, which was in Montevideo in Uruguay, where it was around that time that they also, the Belgica started running into some serious storm systems. And while surviving them united the crew, the availability of alcohol when they stopped at port ended up dividing the crew and causing a lot of conflict. Some of it that led to you know, fisticuffs and broken bones and you know, just brawling in the forecastle. And then it got even worse. The further south they went, the more disciplined and rowdy the crew became. There was a number of chaos agents among them who instigated a conflict with the high command at every chance they got. And part of the problem was because, again, this was not a military nor a government expedition, there was really nothing Dujarlige could do to punish them or keep them in line aside from kicking them off the ship, which he was hesitant to do. It was almost a skeleton crew to begin with. So he felt his hands were tied. And on top of that, he was not a natural disciplinarian. He was, as I said, you know, kind of retiring. And I won't say meek, but he had a much better command of ships than he did of men. And so when it all came to a head in Punta Arenas, there were a number of these Belgian bruisers among the crew who just stopped obeying orders and who stayed ashore drinking and carousing and, you know, for days on end, and would come back only if they wanted to sleep or if they wanted to change clothes. And really, he had lost command of the ship. There wasn't a mutiny, improperly speaking, but, you know, there were all the ingredients for one. As soon as you know, the hierarchy breaks, they were shaking him up, shaking him down for money, even though they weren't even allowed shore leave. They would just say, well, you know, if you don't give me the money, then I will tell everyone back in Belgium that you gave preferential treatment to the Norwegians, and which played to the Dujarlige's worst fears that somehow the Belgian press would turn on him. And, you know, for somebody who sought glory, not just for himself and his family, but for the nation, this was inconceivable. And so he let the crew run roughshod over him, basically blackmail him. And there was a showdown in Punta Arenas, which is the, you know, at that time, the southernmost city in the world and the taking off point for an expedition to Antarctica. There was a showdown, and he was held at gunpoint practically by one of his sailors, and was had to call on the Chilean Navy to come bail him out. And so he ended up kicking four people off the ship. And that reduced the crew even further and, again, had devastating consequences for the months to come.
Okay, so he's already at or even below skeleton crew levels,
yeah.
And they're heading south once again. It's the southern hemisphere summer at this point.
Yeah,
I guess I should ask, what were his goals? In an ideal situation, what did they hope to accomplish when they sailed south? Simply to make a bunch of soundings and chartings like Captain Cook did and go around the shore of Antarctica or possibly go on land? Or what were they hoping for?
They definitely hoped to make landings. There were very few landings that had ever been made. Again, Ross and his expedition in the 1840s had made a few landings on the other side of Antarctica, I guess south of Australia, New Zealand, and Victoria Land. But mostly, they remained on board or on the, stepped foot on the ice. But landings themselves, there weren't that many before the Belgica. And maybe a few whalers in the 1890s had stepped foot on land on the Antarctic Peninsula, which is immediately south of South America. But there had never been a scientific expedition there. So that was the priority. And that's the way he sold the expedition, both to the Royal Geographical Society of Belgium and to the Belgian people when he was, you know, asking them to contribute. So that was important. And he knew that his immediate goal was to begin with an exploration of some of the lands around the Antarctic Peninsula, which was known as Graham Land. And following that, if everything went according to schedule, he would circumnavigate the continent and he was hoping to get to a record southern latitude, as everybody hopes to in that time. It was because that was such an easy goal for people to understand. It was it was something that electrified the public. But on top of that, it was the scientists that he consulted with said that a very important goal would be to reach the magnetic South Pole. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners know this, but when I set out to research this, I didn't know that there's an important distinction between the geographic South Pole, which is what we all conceive of when we think of the South Pole, which is the where all the meridians meet. It's, you know, imagine the Earth is on an, you know, where the axis of the Earth comes out. That's the South Pole. And then there's the magnetic South Pole, which is where, you know, the strongest, the center of magnetism in the South. And that's a constant moving target. It has to do with the churn of magma at the core of the Earth. And that was something that was suspected that was in constant movement, but they wanted to confirm that. And it had never been reached before. And so that was his ultimate goal, is to reach the South Magnetic Pole. And that, again, depended on him making very good time and in circumnavigating Antarctica. And therein lay another conflict. These were in some ways incompatible goals. You couldn't both spend the time required to have a rigorous scientific study of the flora and fauna and geology of the Antarctic lands on the Antarctic Peninsula, and, you know, speed around Antarctica and south to record latitudes where the South Magnetic Pole was suspected to be, in time to get there and back before the winter ice set in. So those were incompatible goals, and he didn't quite realize that at the beginning, but he did plan at first to, if he wasn't able to get to the South Magnetic Pole, he would have retreated back to Melbourne, Australia, and gone and attempted that the following year, attempted to get to the pole the following year. And he hadn't quite figured out how he would do it. Maybe he would land a few people and then come and get them later. And in the meantime, they would, I guess, trek overland to get to the magnetic pole. But again, it was poorly thought through.
Right. And this is there. I would imagine there are a number of unknowns that in later years, it would at least make it easier to plan for an expedition like this, because so much does remain unknown about Antarctica.
Yeah. Yeah.
In terms of what happens with the Antarctic winter to the ship, did the crew expect this? Did they think that this would happen? Did they plan accordingly? So can you describe this first winter down there?
No, again, there was the one thing that he knew he didn't want was to spend a winter down there. And so, as I mentioned, he was thinking that possibly he would land four people on Victoria Land, which, as I mentioned, is south of Australia and was the closest known landing point to the area where the South Magnetic Pole was suspected to be. He would land four people there. So he only had four sets of winter clothes. They had clothes for the cold, but of you know, clothes that were adapted to the lowest temperatures they were expected to see there. So no, there was absolutely zero intention to get caught in Antarctica for the winter, which was started to be of much concern to most on board when they were sailing in the Bellingshausen Sea in the late summer of the late Austral summer. So in late February, 1898, and the ice was only expanding and thickening. And, you know, they could hear it. They could hear the ice getting thicker against the hull of the ship and bumping and making louder jolts against the ship. And those, they were panicking at the idea of getting stuck. And yet de Gerlache was panicking for his own reasons. He was panicking that he would have nothing to show for this journey that he had trumpeted so loudly in Belgium and gotten the public so excited about, if he turned back without having reached a record latitude, let alone a goal like the South Magnetic Pole. So he ended up consulting with his captain. It's a little bit confusing. He was called himself the commander, and there was his second in command was named the captain. His name was Georges Lecointe. They consulted and they agreed, well, we're here now. We've only got one chance to do this. Let's bear south. And so they, against the advice of, they claimed, in order to reassure the crew, that they were only doing this to seek shelter from the storm, and that they would be better protected against the storm by if they made a little headway into the pack ice rather than staying at its fringes, where it was much more dangerous and floes could come and crash against the ship and possibly damage it. But it wasn't that was a pretext. They went way further south and into the pack ice than they would need to if that had been their goal. And sure enough, they went too far to turn back. And in early March 1898, the ice had entirely closed around their ship and would not release them for another 13 months.
So they arrive there. They don't have enough winter clothing for every man on board. Yeah. I'm guessing they don't have nearly enough food for that length of time.
They do.
Oh, they had enough
food.
Okay.
That's the thing. And the problem was the kind of food that they had. Being a Belgian, especially from the Walloon Belgians, who are the French speaking, are very, have a lot of French culture in them. De Gerlache made sure to buy the finest canned foods that he could find, and things that had these very appetizing names, like, rabbit stew or veal blanquette, or, all these. He really spent a lot of money on the canned foods. But the problem is, once, what the label said and what the cans contained were two very different things. And it all turned out to be a kind of gelatinous glop, no matter what was promised on the can. And they had more than enough food to last 3 years, but they got very quickly sick of it. All of it had the same texture. All of it had the same taste and look. So anyway, I'm jumping ahead, but no, they didn't. They did have enough food, but it wasn't just a problem of taste and look and texture. It was also nutrition. It did not give them the nutrition they needed, and which would lead, as many fans of Antarctic and Arctic literature will suspect, to an epidemic of scurvy, which was thought then to have been eradicated, that all you need was to drink lime juice and you would be free of scurvy. But that was after having discovered the cure for scurvy in the 1800s, humanity ended up losing sight of it and trying to, depending on on bottled lime juice as opposed to fresh citrus juice. And bottled lime juice had lost all anti-scorbutic properties because of the bottling process, which ended up destroying the fragile vitamin C molecule. So I'm jumping ahead, but the problem is not that they didn't have enough food. The problem is the food that they had.
And when we talk about scurvy, I think when a lot of modern day people hear it, they just imagine that, oh yeah, it makes your teeth fall out. So discovering a cure, that's a nice little thing there, but that's just a little health matter.
Yeah.
But for crew at the time, it was almost like the cure for cancer. Captain Cook, I think, was just as celebrated on his first voyage for not losing crew to scurvy as he was for any of his discoveries at the time. Yeah. Now, the historical record celebrates him for all of his discoveries, but scurvy, curing that for crew members, just the waking nightmare of any crew of coming down with that. It leads to madness and insanity. It's just absolutely horrible to be surrounded by people dying of scurvy. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Oh yeah, it's a dreadful disease. I mean, it killed, people suspect that it was responsible for the death of millions of sailors. Probably most the cause of the highest number of fatalities in the age of sail was not to drowning or malaria or certainly not the raids by pirates or the things we might imagine. It was scurvy by far, and it was a horrible disease. Yes, your teeth fall out, but that's your legs stop working. Your scars open up. Old scars, 20 years old, open up as if by sorcery because it attacks it breaks down the collagen, which is the glue that holds the body together. And in its later stages, your blood vessels practically liquefy. It's really horrendous. And so, James Cook was sort of, I don't know how much of it was deliberate or how much of it was luck, but because he relied on a diet of sauerkraut, which has what he wouldn't then have known, an abundance of vitamin C, and kept scurvy at bay. But yeah, that by the time one reason that people lost sight of these anti-scorbutic cures by the end of the 19th century is that mechanized or the steam engine had sped up ocean journeys a lot. And so they weren't, people weren't spending months at sea anymore. They were spending maybe weeks at sea. And it takes about 3 months of a vitamin C deficient diet to start exhibiting the first signs of scurvy. And so people started getting a false sense of confidence in these nostrums like bottled lime juice, which had nowhere near the effective, as I mentioned, fresh citrus juice. And so there was nothing on board to keep scurvy at bay. And certainly any fresh vegetables they would have taken with them, the Belgica, from South America would have been consumed or gone bad, by the time they got stuck in the pack ice of the Bellingshausen Sea. So they were up a creek.
The crew does improvise in creative ways for clothing and also nutrition. What do they do to be able to survive?
Well, the one who improvised the most was a guy that we haven't mentioned yet, but he was the American surgeon aboard. He, for his part, was a Barnum-esque character. His name was Frederick Cook, and he had tried to mount an expedition of his own. He was a medical doctor and had been on a number of Arctic expeditions before, but he was not able to secure the funding to mount the kind of expedition he wanted. And he ended up joining this bunch of misfits on the Belgica. And it hiring Cook, even though he was another foreigner, and it could have opened him up to accusations of, you know, undermining the national character of this expedition, de Gerlache made a great decision in hiring Cook, because this was a truly brilliant and ingenious man. He would often bend the truth, and that was his downfall later on in life. But in this case, his ability to think outside the box, so to speak, was life-saving in more ways than one. And you mentioned scurvy. He saw people suffering all around him. He saw, you know, the captain stopped being able to use his legs. People were bedridden. People with their heads were throbbing. They were just sort of, their skin was looking papery and waxy. He noticed all the first signs of scurvy. This was unmistakable, even though he didn't want to mention it because it would have cast such a pall on the ship, and would have just, you know, started a panic if he had mentioned the word scurvy. But he knew very well what this was. And so he figured, well, whatever we're eating isn't working. And he knew that scurvy was something that you could combat through nutrition. And so he figured, well, why don't we eat? You know, he spent time among the Inuit in Greenland. And he noticed that even though they eat only animal products for a large part of the year, they don't develop scurvy. And so he figured, well, what's good for them is going to be good for us. And the conditions in the Arctic are not dissimilar to the conditions in the Antarctic, even though the fauna is different. But he basically prescribed a diet of a penguin and seal rich, in fact, exclusively penguin and seal diet to his crew in order to combat scurvy. And he had no idea that this would work, but he had to try something. And he recommended that it be prepared in the Inuit fashion, which is very lightly cooked, if at all. And lo and behold, those who took his advice immediately started recovering as surely as water douses fire. The meat of penguins and seals was keeping scurvy at bay and reversing these terrifying symptoms. However, many found the meat so disgusting, and I still don't know why, but they refused to eat it, even though they could see that it was having a life-saving effect on their shipmates. And the fact that the commander, de Gerlache, refused for so long to eat it gave license to people to refuse to eat it as well. And so out of pure stubbornness, the epidemic persisted. And again, it's a bit of a mystery why the commander wouldn't just, you know, stifle his gag reflex and eat this life-saving meat. But I think possibly he didn't trust Cook. But in any case, those who did trust him ended up faring a lot better.
I want to get to how they eventually get out. But in the meantime, at the beginning of our discussion, you described these two scientists, one from Poland, the other from Romania.
Yeah.
What does a scientist on an Arctic expedition in the 1890s do? What kind of instruments does he have? And what observations is he making that will be valuable later on?
The instruments are just, for me, that was something that got me really excited to think of the steampunk aesthetic of all these, you know, magnetometers and what are some of the other, the sound, the depth sounds and the microscopes that were affixed to their desks, and then they'd be rocking and trying to, I imagine them observing these slides of microbial life while the ship is rocking back and forth. And it's just, I love that you asked about the instruments, because that was one area where de Gerlache spared no expense. He bought really the most intricate and cutting edge instruments available. So they were studying zoology. And most of the actual studying happened while they were on the Antarctic Peninsula, and because there was much less to study once they were out in the ice. There were penguins and seals, but other than that, there was no plant life, very little bird life aside from penguins. So the zoologists were studying in the phytoplankton, zooplankton in the water. He was studying lichen, studying plants. He climbed up several, you know, 100 feet to get to what was the southernmost flowering plant in the world. And, you know, he was, what else? The whales, you know, abyssal fish and pelagic life, and just cataloging as much of it as he could find, and also taking back as many samples as he could find for Belgian museums back home. And, you know, a lot of, he discovered a number of species, a lot of them still bear the names of members of the Belgica expedition. The Polish scientist that I mentioned, there were two Polish scientists, but the one in charge was Henryk Arctowski, was bringing back information both on the ocean depths on the way down to Antarctica and discovered what is evidence of continental drift and plate tectonics. And you discovered the Scotia Shelf. And, you know, once he was in Antarctica, started taking measurements of barometric pressure, of ocean temperatures, he was taking a survey of the different kinds of the geological formations and figured out that most of it was volcanic. And, one of the questions he was trying to solve was, are the mountains of the Antarctic Peninsula a continuation of the Andes? And it's still not entirely settled, but he gathered evidence to try to answer that question. And then meteorological data. It was the first time that anybody had closely studied the day-to-day weather of the Antarctic. And so those were pretty valuable data to gather. And then there was a man named Emil Danko, who was de Gerlache's best friend and not a skilled scientist, although he had every desire to be, and he didn't lack for enthusiasm. He was designated as the magnetician of the expedition, which was to chart the variations of the magnetic field in that area, which had its uses in cartography and in navigation. But he was just, you know, he didn't cut it as a scientist. And so much of what, and he didn't know how to use those incredible steampunk tools. And so much of what he got, the information he gathered, was completely useless. But again, he was a beloved presence on the ship. He just didn't really contribute much.
The crew was trapped for 13 months. Can you describe how were they doing at the end? Were some people losing their sanity? How did they get out? And and in describing how they were doing, I understand you went to Antarctica to actually get a sense of what it was like down there. So by doing so, I'd imagine you got a different perspective than just reading an account in a heated room where it's an ambient 72 degrees all the time. So,
well, you'd be surprised how well they can control the temperature on the cruise ships that I went on. Certainly different experience in watching these sublime landscapes flow by from the window of the bar of the Hebridean Sky, which is the ship that I was on, and sipping a martini. And it's quite different from what they experienced in 1898. But yeah, I went in the height of the austral summer and cruised down the Gerlache Strait. And there was no, you know, we saw a few icebergs, but there was no risk of getting caught in the ice. So yes, I was able to see the sights and breathe the smells and hear the sounds of the Antarctic. And that was valuable for painting the landscape in the book. I did stop short of letting myself getting imprisoned in the ice and living on a diet of penguin and seal. But so, yeah, the men, after May 17th, I believe, is when the sun went down for the last time and didn't go up for another 90 days. And even when it did come up, it was for very short bursts. They started, losing their grip on sanity. And some ended up going truly mad and never recovering their reason. But strangely, the darkness and the cold, I think, had less to do with it than the isolation, because most of the most severe symptoms of mental illness showed up after the sun came back. And this is something that has been observed in polar expeditions since, although never quite to the degree of the Belgica, or I should say rarely to that degree, is that the most troubling mental symptoms occur in what's known as in the third quarter, basically, when the sun returns for people spending more than a year in Antarctica. And that's, you know, psychologists sort of speculate that it has to do with the fact that you were putting all of your hopes in the return of the sun. And when it does return and you realize you're still stuck and you're still so uncertain, you have very little hope of breaking out of the ice, that's when despondency really sets in. And that was definitely the case with several of the members of the Belgica, who hallucinated, who didn't even remember where they were, you know, were started getting delusions of grandeur or violent instincts or fears or crippling paranoia. There's frequently, and this is something that, again, I've seen mentioned in many expeditions since, again, not quite to the degree of the Belgica, but there is among people who become mentally imbalanced because of the conditions of the pole, of polar travel, there is frequently a fear of, a fascination with violence, either a fear of being hurt or, you know, a desire to commit violence. And, you know, a bit of a tangent, but that we have we've had examples of that even in today's age where people are screened for are given psychological screening beforehand. Even then, just a few years ago on a Russian base on King George Island, which I visited in the South Shetland Islands, a scientist stabbed his colleague with a knife in the cafeteria, supposedly because for the crime of ruining the endings of books. So, you know, these were people who we had every reason to think were stable and were not going to, you know, lose their minds in the Antarctic. But again, you know, those kinds of psychotic moments can happen anywhere at any time. But you would think that the incidence would be lower when these days when we specifically screen for that. But the Antarctic and the isolation and the cold and the dark, all these factors combined do tend to cause these kinds of mental reactions.
In the Russian case, that once again highlights the importance of spoiler alerts when you're talking about the endings of things. Yeah. So listeners, be very aware of that.
You know, it's a you know, that's something definitely that people are studying, that NASA is studying in when it's preparing these manned missions to Mars. You know, there've been several, I guess, trial runs on Earth of simulations in these controlled environments, but that are meant to simulate the long isolation and confinement of deep space missions. And those are just as, if not more, prone to causing mental distress than the Antarctic expeditions of the turn of the century. But the space programs are studying Antarctic and Arctic missions very closely in order to learn from the experience of those explorers and avoid those kinds of problems, which would be even more disastrous out in space.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. And you read firsthand accounts of this. And one thing I'm curious about is for crew members who lost their sanity versus those who were able to continue, and some who even went on future Arctic explorations after all the hardship they went, is there any rhyme or reason to those who are able to make it? I mean, I'm thinking of like a Viktor Frankl book, Man's Search for Meaning, where he talks about those who are able to survive concentration camps, just the worst situations you could possibly imagine, because they have hope, they have something that they're holding on to. Did you get any sense of that? Or is there not really, one can't know how they would last in that situation unless they went through it or anything?
Yeah, there's definitely an element of that. I think Dzerzhelov, for example, imagined himself to be a great polar hero, and that he prepared himself for hardship, but he didn't have it in him. You know, he was a great sailor, but he didn't have the constitution or the fortitude, and in fact suffered more than the majority of his shipmates. He never lost his mind, I would say, but he did come. He was basically at the brink of death for much of the expedition. However, there's two of the men we've mentioned, Frederick Cook and Roald Amundsen, thrive. Yes, they felt some physical symptoms, but they never lost their mind, and they actually were excited by this. I think part of what it was is that they were looking forward to the suffering in a way, especially Amundsen, as a kind of preparation. They both had in mind to launch their own expeditions later on, so they saw this as a kind of a boot camp almost. So when their shipmates were stuck on board and were, you know, bemoaning their condition, Cook and Amundsen would leave on these extended journeys across the sea ice. They're incredibly dangerous. The ice could break at any moment, and the pack was an eternal shift, and they could easily lose sight of the ship and just be stuck there. And that would surely be a death sentence. But they loved it. They, you know, Amundsen had mentioned that what drew him to Arctic travel was the suffering, and he was certainly a masochist. And that also just as certainly explains why he was so successful as a polar explorer. And so, yeah, there is a certain element of physical constitution and preparedness, but I think and Amundsen was a specimen. He was 6'2", 200 pounds of pure muscle. And, you know, Cook was a smaller guy, but still very agile and physically fit. And all of these guys were in their late 20s or early 30s. So I think it really is a question of mental preparedness and what they were expecting to get out of this. And, you know, some of the Belgian sailors just wanted a meal ticket, or they wanted to, you know, avoid troubles back home, or, you know, they just weren't prepared for it. And then even the great sailors, one of the men who permanently lost his mind, a Norwegian sailor named Adam Tollefsen, was an exceptional sailor. And he had experience on whaling ships in the Arctic. So he was familiar with the cold. And yet he suffered tremendously and couldn't even make, you know, he was completely illogical by the end of the, and just spouting nonsense by the end of the trip. So experience has little to do with it.
Well, the crew is able to eventually get out, the ice breaks, and they can return.
Well, the ice wouldn't have broken on its own. They were the agents of their own escape. They sawed through a mile's worth of ice,
wow.
3 to 6 feet thick, and had to crisscross this ice in order to cut off sections and create a canal for the ship, and they had to continually expand the canal, which was being closed by the pressures of the ice. And so it was just a Herculean task. That's one thing I don't want listeners to think that it was somehow the ice just relinquished them. No, they were, the thawing of the coming of the summer did help loosen the ice a little bit, but there was no way they would have escaped if not for this tremendous effort required of men who were physically atrophied. It was just a mind-blowing initiative that ended up saving, keeping this from becoming the next Franklin expedition.
Right. I mean, I imagine that's misery, months of sawing. And I understand they use dynamite as well to try to get through. When they're able to finally get out and return, I think they go back up north. They return to Antwerp. What's the reception like to the crew?
Joyous. And, you know, all of a sudden the government that had only reluctantly committed funds to this expedition, all of a sudden was singing de Gerlache's praises and trumpeting his accomplishments throughout. And they didn't seem to care all that much that he had not achieved a record southern latitude, or that he didn't reach the magnetic South Pole, or just I think that the suffering of the ship and the fact that they lost several men ended up being accomplishment enough. They had a great story to tell, and that's what counted for the men and women back home.
I'd like to talk about the legacy. You mentioned some of the things that NASA has studied, the lessons on physical and psychological limits of the body when they're considering manned space exploration. But with the Belgica, I mean, it's not known like the Endurance, Ernest Shackleton's ship, or even the Franklin expedition. Although it's probably good it's not known like the Franklin expedition for the reasons we discussed. But why is it not as well known, simply because it's not a British expedition, or some other reason?
Yeah, that's it. I think that's exactly it. And I'm very glad it wasn't known, because I was able to, to write about this unexplored topic or a little explored topic. But I think that we are pretty, the British ended up capturing the imagination of the Anglophone world. And, there's other expeditions that we don't care as much about. You know, William Barents, that was the subject of a new book called Icebound, was Dutch, and so we know less about him, even though this was a much earlier expedition. But still, there's even Amundsen, up until the work of Roland Huntford, who wrote about him in the 80s, very little was known about it, except, and the British almost resented him for having beaten their man, Scott, to the South Pole. And there is just a disproportionate amount of attention paid to expedition, British expeditions, I believe.
And Amundsen, I mean, it's just incredible what he does. He manages to go through the Northwest Passage, which had been attempted for something like 400 or 500 years at that point, goes to the South Pole, may or may not have gone to the North Pole, although I did have a guest on who disputed that. It was a very interesting point. That's still up.
What did he say?
I didn't. Well, he argues that it was, is it Scott? Is that right? The other pilot?
Yeah. What's his name?
Bird.
Bird, yes.
Right.
Admiral Bird.
So I didn't know there was such a controversy in this subculture of polar exploration, but very fiercely heated debate still today. Although neither here nor there, the point is that Amundsen had incredible accomplishments. But I guess I get to the point of what you see as a legacy of the Belgica, in addition to what we described. Do you think it's what Amundsen learned here that he applied later, or other things, or what do you see as the legacy of it?
That is definitely a legacy, is that it formed the most accomplished polar explorer that I would argue has ever lived. But I think that one important legacy is that it was done under, even though there were, nationalistic overtones, de Gerlache himself was not a nationalist, and he refused to claim the land in the name of the king, which was something that had been done by previous Antarctic expeditions. For example, I mentioned James Clark Ross had named Victoria after the queen and claimed and laid a claim to it on behalf of the United Kingdom. Dvořilák never did that. Yes, he named many areas of the Antarctic Peninsula after Belgian names to the extent that now, if you look at a map of the Antarctic Peninsula, it looks like a map of Belgium. If Belgium had a much more exciting landscape. But so, no, I think that the fact that he, this was under the Belgian flag, but it was really in the name of science. And the fact that it was an international crew, I think, was an international scientific group of scientists that ended up setting a precedent for exploration that I would argue led directly to the Antarctic Treaty of 1959, which was signed by a large number of nations, where they refused to militarize the Antarctic. They agreed to cooperate. And the Antarctic, since the Belgica, and I think in part because of the Belgica, has is a shining example of human cooperation and peace. And who knows how long that'll last. But I think that that has a lot to do with Dvořilák's decisions and his outlook. And that, in turn, leads directly sets a precedent for cooperation in space. You see, the International Space Station is one of the rare moments of light in an otherwise contentious relationship between, you know, Russia and some of the Western powers. And I hope that, unlike the exploration of the New World, that I hope that the exploration of space goes a lot more like the exploration of Antarctica than the exploration of the New World.
Right. And well, yeah, this is a really interesting chapter in the story of discovery, and sounds like the many of the lessons will be applied to the future. Well, thank you for sharing all this with us. And sometimes I have people who tell stories of their book, but they cut it off halfway through because they think somehow their publicist will pressure them not to tell the story. But you know what? The joke's on them, because I found that listeners tend to be more engaged and perhaps even get into the book when they want to get into all the details. And when I talk about book topics with authors, there's so many stories we can't get into just because of the breadth of the detail they go into. So
yeah, well, since you're not standing across from me in an Antarctic cafeteria, I figure I could do away with the spoiler alert.
Makes sense. So the name of the book is Madhouse at the End of the Earth, The Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. Julian, thank you for joining us.
Scott, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Frieza. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group, and here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplug. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.